You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
Thank you for the introduction.
Yes, you're welcome. My pleasure.
I'll just tell you a little bit more about myself. I have a master's degree from Indiana University in International Studies. I went on there. I chose the folklore department there because it is an anthropology-based folklore department. It was the department that encouraged me to go and do fieldwork during the Singing Revolution, during the nonviolent independence movement of the Baltic countries. I do oral history, which has been, for most of my career, has been what I wrote one book about it, and then I just keep thinking back to it. It's a case study in world nonviolent political action history of the Baltic countries. Never has a nonviolent movement gotten victory over a nuclear superpower and getting independence. So that's the ball. That's me. I was hired by the UW before I finished my dissertation because they wanted to teach Estonian, Latin, Lithuanian languages, and I said, I'm your man. You know, every graduate student wants a job. And that was part of Dan Wong, who founded the Baltic program, head of RECAS, said it was a national security threat that there are three countries that have emerged in the world and we have no American specialists who know those languages. And so somebody has to start teaching them. Language, non-English language instruction is my little agenda here at the university. Every time that there's a faculty meeting, I always make noise about it. It's all the languages. Right now, United States is going towards firing all language faculty in West Virginia. We'll replace it by an app. Is what they're saying.
Not to interrupt, but you need to talk to Michelle.
Well, we know exactly.
Yes, let's talk.
Oh, you do.
And so I wear this bracelet because the Ukrainian language lecturer gave it to me because of the support I give to foreign languages. Our Ukrainian instruction depends entirely on the Fulbright program. University of Washington is not investing in it aside from giving classrooms. And so that's my little agenda is how can we, today we've been talking around Ukraine a whole lot.
Yeah.
Europe is talking about Ukraine very much, and there are so few people who know Ukraine from inside. My entry into Ukraine has been through the Baltic countries, and I'll get to that in a minute. If you don't speak Ukrainian language, you're probably not going to say anything useful about what Ukraine, what we should do for Ukraine, or not do for Ukraine. So the article that kind of inspired my title is by another German scholar named Benjamin Tallis. It's about new idealists. Shortly, it goes through political science theories about what is realism and what is idealism and all this. Basically, new idealists say our values, and our values are human rights, democracy, are our interests. Where 2 years ago, people were willing to sacrifice, support for democracy and so on, just to keep the power structures of the world going. There's a new movement, and actually it is a very large, broad, geographically large movement where smaller nations are asserting their power geopolitically. And that's where new idealism comes from. Saying your values are your first interest and then being willing to fight for your values. The president of Latvia, just elected now, as when he was foreign minister, one of the most popular foreign ministers of Latvia, said, we are ready to die for our values. Are you? When he's speaking to us. I know, for me, my name might drive throw you off. I'm born and raised. My father's, both, all three of them, my father, grandfather's, all died here in this country, land where my father's died. So when they talk about America, they're talking about me, too. So there's new ideals and values or interests. The values are ideals, human rights, rule of law, democracy, sovereignty of countries, are all things that have been established very recently in world history as something that is ideal for the countries of the world. Progress means working towards that. And if you're not working towards democracy and human rights, you are not working for progress, basically, new idealists say. So they are very assertive to speak truth to power, meaning us, when we are willing to sacrifice values. And talk about realists, let's pay for a very expensive pipeline around Ukraine, for example, to appease Russia. And they challenge us on this, and we have to be ready on that when we talk to them, because they are definitely agents. A flaw of American scholars often is that they take agency away from all the people other than Russia when they're talking about that, about Europe, you know, that part of the world. So Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, I have a slide here that gives you basically, you know, the same NATO and European Union slides. 3.5 decades of integration into those, membership 20 years ago. Baltic countries will say that European Union is not expanded by its center. European Union, they fought incredibly to get into the European Union and to get into NATO. So 35 years ago, they started building a civilian-controlled military, which is, you know, basically soldiers are fed by civilians. The whole infrastructure of American army is based on civilians. Building that very early on, Latvia signs an agreement with Michigan National Guard, Estonia with Massachusetts, Lithuania with Pennsylvania, learning from the National Guards of those states how to run a country that's run by its, a military that's run by its civilians. That's that. With European Union, they were signing bilateral treaties, free trade agreements with the United Kingdom, for example, very early on. That was when UK was still in. But then, you know, with other countries too, which forced them to act like they were members of European Union, regardless of whether they had that whole treaty, accession to the European Union. The biggest stumbling block for them to getting into the European Union was French farmers protecting their agriculture. The European Union doesn't, cheap agriculture was something that the Western Europeans didn't want coming in. No matter if it's clean and safe and all that, they didn't want to be, they wanted to protect their farmers for all. Estonia sacrificed its farming economy to get into the European Union. So that would be the history of integration into the European Union, which began in 1992, before my students were born, long. I have been reorienting very much to know that the movers and shakers in that part of the world are all much younger than me. Zelensky, 45 years old, 15 years younger than me. And so my, you know, going to graduate school in the old Cold War period offers me very little for understanding what's going on in their minds, actually. The majority of voters don't remember the Soviet Union in this part of the world. All right, so, and these values are things that are there in the European Union too. When you hear Ursula von der Leyen saying about Ukraine, they are like us, we want them in. It's based on values, it's not based on appeasement for cheap energy. Because it's a democracy, and you know the values, human rights, we want them in, we want to defend it, is what NATO says. Geopolitics is a word invented by a Swedish geographer, by the way, 100 years ago. And it's how geography and politics overlap. The classic understanding, and most high school students understand geopolitics the way they understand the game of Risk, if you've played that game, which is absolutely doesn't teach you international. Well, it does. You know, the game of Risk is you have these little pieces on the board, and the more soldiers you have on territory, the easier it is to just take over. You clear out everybody from another territory and just have your soldiers, and you multiply soldiers. The more territory you have, the more you multiply your soldiers. And that is how the world was run under monarchs and monarchies, under empires. And so thinking of geopolitics, it's more productive today to see early 20th century as the map where we start with, when England was the largest country in the world. France had an enormous empire. All those empires are gone except for one, which is the Russian Empire. To see the 20th century as a collapse of empires, these are not my ideas, Timothy Snyder is the first one I'm going to be, collapse of empires, or kind of reorientation towards, against, I know there's a long colonial heritage in non-Europe and so on, but dealing with that is Europe's burden now, because the empire is gone. It's a post-imperial world, would be how geopolitics has changed. It changed in 1945, if you want a date when it happened, when the United Nations was established to prevent another world war. That was the reason the United Nations was established. It's the Charter of the United Nations says, okay, whatever countries we have in the world right now, those are the sovereign countries. We will never change borders again by war. Is the agreement, consensus of all the countries in the world. Let's, you know, they're exceptions, but I'm giving you the simplified version. And then 3 years later, not only they said that aggression is a word that we use, we should be using if we're in the academic context, very carefully, because it has a legal definition, and that's a definition by the United Nations. So we can say countries, aggression. Let's use that word. And then 3 years later, the United Nations established, by consensus again, values on what is good and what is bad in human international relations. There's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a document that you should really, really read now to decide if those are your values. And again, aspiring towards that. You know, basically, every person has a right to say what they want, to assemble with whoever they want, to vote for a government. Those are human rights, etc. To not be persecuted because of what they were born. We're struggling with that one still, but we're struggling towards something. And the other value judgment that was passed by the United Nations was the Convention on Genocide. So where human rights is used not carefully by many people out there outside of the university, we know that it is a defined legal term, as is genocide, a legally defined term. It says, this is genocide. Taking children from one country and taking them somewhere else to another country is genocide. Therefore, when the president of Russia praises one of his administrators for taking Ukrainian children to Russia, there has never been a case where a country openly admits doing genocide. It was always plausible deniability. People were doing things that kind of go against these things. But 2022 was the moment when a country openly challenged the United Nations Charter and these international treaties. So it's a completely different world after 2022. And that is what has mobilized geopolitics, global geopolitics, and the new idealism. Okay, that my own research, a little bit on that.
You're good.
Okay, is, I mentioned nonviolent politics in the Baltic, but very specifically, one cultural expression, that is singing. So just a few weeks ago, I returned from Latvia, which had their national song celebration, which is once every 5 years. I call it like a giant flash mob, because that's part of what it is. These choirs, 16,000 singers from all over the country, Estonia does this too, Lithuania does it too, who have been rehearsing twice a week, not for just this. They rehearse because choir music is a thing in the Baltic. But they've been meeting twice a week, and then once every 5 years, they all meet on a stage and they sing. American choirs can't do that, because that, it's a whole musical instrument where you have to learn how to sing with 16,000. The composers learn how to compose fantastic stuff, the conductors. Anyways, that cultural expression is what I study. And when I was looking at that choir in early July in Latvia, and then the 16,000 singers, add to that the folk dance festival, the national folk, where dancers come across and dance in this massive, it's very much like a flash mob, if you've seen the smaller flash mob things. 40,000 participants, that is 2% of the population of Latvia. And if we add their audiences and family members, these are all adults, by the way. Estonia brings in children, you know, they're different, but we bring it and we say, and these are taxpayers and voters in the countries. I am not studying something trivial. I'm studying something that, because they tell me it's the central thing in their country's politics and existence, I'm actually studying the central thing for Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians when I study these. So Latvians carry a flag that they've been carrying since 1873. So 150-year tradition is with this. That was 1,000 singers only, they say. Only 1,000 singers came from all over the territory of Latvia, which was not a country, it wasn't even an administrative place. And back then, they were dealing with two colonialisms. One was the cultural hegemony in Latvia was German-speaking. The middle and upper classes of Estonia and Latvia were all German-speaking, most of them of noble ancestry. That's how it was a monarchy, and those were the people who had power, economic and political power. And they were also racists. So when there's this parade of 1,000 singers, there are comments, whoa, look at the farmers. Oh, he's wearing a tux. So they were dealing with cultural colonialism then. saying, yeah, we can, and they were singing modern choral music at that time, proving that the Latvian people are not just former serfs, because 200 years ago they were serfs, which is very much experienced like slavery. They were bought, sold, raped, beat, you know, that was their, so they have emerged from serfdom to create this modern art. That was 1873, and right after 1873 came Russian cultural colonialism, also, which banned the languages from schools. 1873, already Lithuania and Eastern Latvia had the book ban, meaning Lithuanian and Eastern Latvian language, which is different, were not allowed in print. Public assemblies were not allowed because of the 1863 revolution, another event that's forgotten, when Belarus, Poland, and Lithuania fought to renew constitutional rule. But they were repressed again by Russian colonial power, Russian military power. And this is what's happening around 1873, all the way into the present day. All right, so the expressions are different. There's no German, there is something about English speaking, you know, cultural hegemony in the world. You don't speak English. Adios, amigos. That was a poster here in Washington. But generally, they're not dealing with those colonialisms anywhere. But this year was entirely different from that 150-year anniversary, because the central song that they sang was the national anthem of Ukraine, in Ukrainian. Shtenye v meri Ukraini ni slavanie volya. Ukraine's glory and freedom are nevertheless not yet killed. Are not yet dead, they had never sung. It's a Latvian language festival. You know, there's other multi-ethnic festivals happening in Latvia also, but this is a Latvian. They had never done this, and then in front, there was a boys' men's choir from Ukraine that had been performing in Latvia at that time, singing along with them, dressed in the red, white, red colors. What is red, white, red colors? It's national colors of Latvia. Singing Latvia's national anthem. Singing, there's a couple of those, you know, core, very important identity songs. Singing those songs with them. Walking up and down the... one thing that happens in the Baltic, you keep running into people who you see in the news. I mean, it's not uncommon to see the Prime Minister walking down the street, or some, you know, the most famous musician buying something in the grocery store. Population, just so you know, I'll simplify, 1, 2, 3 million. It's still alphabetical. Estonia 1, Latvia 2, Lithuania 3 million. So politics is very up and close, and I experienced that when I was just walking back from the bathroom. I go to the bathroom a lot. there was the chair of Latvia's parliament with the chair of Ukraine's parliament standing next to each other talking. Both of them had come to this concert. A 3.5-hour long concert. And so what my takeaway from that is that they talk to each other, by the way. They have agency. And they talk to each other about us. They know what each other's interests and needs and ideals are. And I think that some of the most piercing analyses of what our American capabilities and weaknesses are, those analyses are probably happening over where people's lives depend on, knowing what the United States will do, is my takeaway there. And then dealing or planning for possibly not having a United States around. So that's the takeaway. Give them agency. If you are studying the Baltic countries, you definitely listen to their elected leaders first. They probably know every problem that you're talking about better than you. Probably they've given interviews about it in those languages. So we Americans, that's what I drive my students towards. All right, so there's that. Now, where's the friendship with Ukraine? That's when it starts last year, January of 2022, when the Baltic countries started sending Stinger missiles and Javelin anti-tank missiles to Ukraine. They were not doubting that Russia, those hundreds of thousands of soldiers on the Ukraine border, were going to invade. And they gave Ukraine what it needed. Now, Ukraine's artillery defeated that run for Kyiv. But those anti-tank and anti-helicopter missiles did a great share there, too. Estonia kept its embassy in Kyiv. for the entire first 2 months of the war, when everybody else, including us, left. And so when they are talking to each other, they know that they're in the long haul for each other. Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Latvians, they sing Ukraine's national anthem, saying, you know, they, we are them. And Ukrainians see them singing and say, they are us. For one, it's good to not be alone in the world as you're being genocided. And for the other, it's good to know that you're not alone in the world in case that unspeakable thing happens to your country. So there's that. Taxpayers. Now, Estonia is the largest. Estonia's government, when you measure GDP, percentage of GDP going financial aid to Ukraine, Estonia is right up there at the top, highest percentage of money from GDP going to Ukraine. Latvia, Lithuania, Poland is up there too, are also much higher than any other countries. And we can say that their aid, financial aid, is a little bit different from many other countries, which basically pick their surplus stock, value it, and send it to Ukraine and say, I'm sending weapons worth this money. In other words, when America is sending aid to Ukraine, they're usually sending money that has been spent in the United States. And slightly outdated. Outdated weapons are still very strong. Slightly outdated weapons to Ukraine is what they're doing. Baltic countries have bought those Swedish anti-tank guns that they sent. Estonia sent all of its anti-tank guns to Ukraine. When they send money, they send cash to Ukraine. And how do taxpayers tolerate this? Well, we don't have to look far to see what the public in the Baltic is doing. A popular journalist in Lithuania announced a crowd fund to buy a $5 million drone for Ukraine. And it was donated in small donations. $6 million, not $5 million. Latvia, the Twitter convoy, it started in the first month of the war. That a journalist said, if you want to donate your SUV, we'll collect them in a convoy and we'll drive through Poland to Ukraine because soldiers on the ground need cars. And those cars keep getting lost. And so by fall, it's over 1,000 cars that people have donated to Ukraine. Most of them SUV kind of cars. So there's the public support that extends, and this is not calculated when we calculate what countries are doing to support Ukraine. And I don't have my slides to guide me. Then there's this moral support, these singing. It is up there. Yay,
no.
When it comes. All right, so when it sticks, I'll have it. It doesn't matter. I won't share on YouTube. I'm not going to spend time with this YouTube video. But so one thing that happened within days of the invasion, or the escalated invasion, the war had been, thousands of soldiers were killed between 2014 and 2022 on those front lines, also Russians and Ukrainians. But when it was escalated in 2022, what happened was they recorded and put in YouTube the deepest fight song of Ukrainians today, which is Oyu Luzi. You might know it's this. Leading Latvian, Lithuanian, Estonian singers kind of posted YouTubes of very well done videos of this song. And the Latvians, what they had done was, because over these 30 years with open borders, Latvian musicians have contacts all over the world, they mobilized singers. I don't know how many countries. And then they pieced together this video of, you know, somebody singing one line in India, another person singing it in Brazil, and somebody else in Canada, and somebody else in Belarus. And so this long line, the chorus is, and we will cheer up our precious, our glorious Ukraine, our glorious Ukraine. And so they took this idea, this was before the national anthem at the Song Festival, and multiplied that by internet. Getting the whole world. Obviously, I don't think you'll agree that the banjo player represents us, but there's that American singer representing his country, also expressing support for Ukraine. So that's what they did. And I noticed, people stereotype the Baltic countries as the same, and I definitely know there's large differences between the three. They find consensus on things. And so one in that song, I noticed that the Latvians, there was a choir from Latvia singing their line. And their line was, and we will hold the glory of the riflemen of Sich. What is Sich? It's southern Ukraine. It's a song that was written in the 1800s, became popular in 1918 when Ukraine was fighting for its independence. That word rifleman in Latvian culture and Ukrainian culture, Strelets, Strelniks, Latvian, held the same cultural weight. I have this like historical timeline at the end of it. In 1918, there's a statue of Latvian riflemen, which Latvian what is a statue in Latvia? It's three soldiers standing back to back. The story is that two of them fought in imperial armories in World War I and the Russian Revolution. The Russian Imperial Army, the Soviet Imperial Army. Both of them were killed by the countries for whom they fought. And then there's the one who fought for Latvian independence in 1918 and won that war. And today all three of them stand back to back saying, you know, it's the symbol is we know that none of these empires have our back.
I stood in front of that statue less than a month ago.
There you go. So now you know a story. And so the Latvian Riflemen's, it was a blockbuster film in 2019. It's the biggest war film that Latvians have. It's a very realistic war film. You know, and lots of participation in the, you know, the extras. So Latvians go there to watch that film of soldiers in trenches getting killed, or killing, stabbing and killing. And they see familiar, you know, they say, oh, that's so-and-so. So that film, which is viscerally felt in Latvia, refers to that statue and all of that whole thing. The war for independence resonates with Ukraine and knowledge that Ukraine lost its war for independence in 1918. 3 years of an independent republic, and that was it for Ukraine. So then they think more, like what's... Now, these things about how to remember history sound kind of touchy-feely to political scientists, I know. When I have been invited to give lectures to American military who are working with the Baltic countries, they want to hear, who are their heroes? What are their rituals? I tell them about the Zons Festival, and they take it very seriously. What are their historical memories? And so I just give you historical memories. Another memory they have is of genocide. The person who fought for the word genocide to be put in United Nations Convention said, Ukrainian Holodomor, the 1930s, the planned starvation of 6 million Ukrainians was a genocide. That same person said the deportation of Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians was a genocide also. And so they have finally been, now that the word genocide is back for people talking about it, they have the affirmation. They've always been told by people that that's not genocide, that's not genocide. But they, amongst themselves, they know that it is, that there is a Russian-speaking empire, which recently announced there is no Ukraine, there is no Ukrainian people, and then attacked. And they know that that has been the history of the Baltic also. So their memories go back to that, 1930s through early 1950s genocide. Then their memories go back to the 1988 Singing Revolution. I studied the Baltic one, and it was this eye-opening thing to find out, oh, Ukrainians also had a singing revolution. The Balts had this 600-mile-long hands across the Baltic that they mobilized without, you know, social media, and expressing people power, unity in their independence movement. Ukrainians did that across Ukraine, too, Balts will tell you, et cetera. And then changing government, a revolution with no blood in it.
Don't drink it. Keep going, Vuntis.
Is the memory of what happened in 1988 and was institutionalized in 1991. They declared independence in 1990. 1991 is when the countries were brought into the United Nations. So that nonviolent move to democracy is heavy on their memories. And then comes more memories.
Oh,
yay.
We're here.
Yay. Then we'll just
skip
through. I'll go to where there's this road leading across these. Oh, you see these things. Yeah, there's the risk. There's the song. Oh, yeah, that Song Festival flag. It was anti-colonial, but then when they interpret this flag back in 1873, they say this is the ancient shaman of the Latvian people. Always, you know, inventing national myths, who is teaching his people where there is peace, there is happiness. And Latvia's women had donated money, so there's 18 women 18 men, 18 women standing by this flag, had donated, and the rhetoric around the flag was that may peace be with you, singing at the song celebration of all the nations of the world who sing because that's the path to happiness. So they had a global message, which only Latvians heard in 1873, by the way. All right, so there's that. Now, skip ahead. I won't chase it. There's the video. There's this. And then finally, 1992, and you see democracy is incomplete.
Is that the statue?
That's the statue.
Is that the one you were in front of?
But let's get to incomplete democracy, because when they talk to Ukrainians, they know...
So just use the arrow.
Okay. They know that Ukraine also had, it's called a resource curse. Latvia had a oil pipeline running through Latvia, like Ukraine had its gas pipeline. What that meant was whoever controls that pipeline was making money hand over foot. Meaning there were local, the way it was run was there are local intermediary companies. Russia sells cheaply to them. They sell at market prices when they export. And lots of money running into the dark political economy, corrupting the whole country. Was the side effect of those, you know, money-making pipelines, but a corrupt politics. And so trying to win their country back for democracy from powerful oligarchs, the business people who use their businesses to control politics to become wealthier, is something where Ukrainians and Latvians, you know, the servant of the people, this is how Zelensky became popular, not as a comedian, but as a person elected to be president, you know, man on the street, dealing with corrupt oligarchs. That film is known well in the Baltics also, and they say, our people. Okay. So when they're talking to, the history goes back, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians have been singing Ukrainian songs for much, much longer, and understanding, knowing that Ukrainian language is not, you can't understand Ukrainian if you speak Russian. It's a different language. Knowing that Ukrainian identity culture is all different, and it's threatened in the same way that their culture is threatened, that their independence, actually their lives are threatened by Russian colonialism. Okay, so. Now, one more. One more slide, thank you. So 2014 is this turning point. In the Baltic, I was doing field work at another singing festival, the Global Choir Games, which is about 40,000 singers from about 100 countries. I mean, they compete at the choir games. It's different from the Olympics because if you're a high quality choir, you get a gold medal. So people compete for, and it really is the best choirs get gold medals, second best. Second level, get silver, bronze, you have to earn. It's very difficult to get bronze medals. So that's what the World Choir Games is. At the Games, there was an event where the board of the World Choir Games, for the first time ever, awarded a World Choir Peace Prize to Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian people related to their singing revolution. And then at that same festival, there was a procession of singers, all of the international singers, and there was a very in-your-face choir from Russia, 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 chanting it, carrying, this is Russia's flag with a aggressively attacking bear on it. Mm-hmm. And this is the old imperial flag of the Russian Tsars, which says, we are Russians, God is with us. Mm-hmm. So here is this, Russian choirs, most of the foreigners did not understand what was happening. I mean, other choirs had spirit also. Even when Russian soldiers, and it is clearly known Russian military shot down a civilian passenger jet over Ukraine, the Netherlands, killing almost 300 people. Most of the foreigners didn't know. Speaking to the Baltic, and I speak their languages, so I see what they're saying amongst themselves too. They knew that things had changed beyond going back anymore. In 2014, they said they had been protesting the United States taking Abrams tanks. The United States took all its tanks out of Europe shortly before this, or right around this time, basically. If we're saying Europe without Russia, without the United States, Baltic countries were looking at a Europe without American tanks. for one, you know, the friendship gesture towards Russia. We're noticing all these other countries that have been appeasing. Appeasement means giving up the moral values to acquire material goods. And so Angela Merkel, sorry. And already it is not a, but Gerhard Schroeder is perfect. All right, so 2014 was the turning point for them. They followed news for these past 9 years, knowing about what's happening on the front lines there. And actually, 2014 was not the start for them. They had been protesting Russian military occupations since get-go from being independent. 1992, when Russia occupied a part of Georgia, Abkhazia, and a part of Moldova, Transnistria. There was no protest of this, but it was just Baltic countries basically protesting this. 1995, Estonia recognized the independence of Ichkeria, which most of us don't know what Ichkeria is. It's Chechnya, declared independence. And then watched as Chechnya's cities were completely leveled and civilians killed en masse, the country emptied out. And remembering 1945 when the Soviet Union came back, the tactics was to level cities in order to drive people out and make it impossible for people to live, and then colonize after that. So there's Ichkeria or Chechnya, there is the invasion of Georgia, 2008, when Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia sent their presidents or the prime minister down to Georgia at the moment when Russia was still attacking in Tbilisi, saying basically come and get us. If you're going to invade Georgia, then we are here. So all these, that's a symbolic step, but all these symbolic steps have something, they're coming from some real place. Now, up to that point, we can say, well, there's some sort of Russophobia going on in the Baltic. Basically, their interests are to not get killed. That's why they are anti-Russian. Where, from the 1990s, from the get-go, we see them also standing up for other colonized peoples, breaking out of colonial empires. China, or Taiwan, is the big, where Latvia had diplomatic relations with Taiwan for a time before Westerners sort of pressured Latvia to appease China and start diplomatic relations with communist China, and so on. So this fighting for democracy, people who are like us challenging empires. By the way, I traveled to the Baltic with our UW choirs, and they do Baltic 5 times, they've done tours, and the choir professor says, when they perform any song, they say, we sing other people's stories, is what they do. That's how they do the international thing, is they try to become those people and sing. I'm sort of doing that, always maintaining my cool, but I think it's useful for you to see what inside these countries people are saying about that.
Is that unique to that region?
So Taiwan is.
Okay.
So there was a massive international splash last year when Lithuania allowed Taiwan. This picture is an international incident, if you want to know. Because relations are allowed with Taipei.
Right.
So there's a Taipei representation. I think we have one here in Seattle, too.
We do. Yes.
Lithuania allowed the Taiwanese representation in Vilnius, the capital city of Lithuania. Mm-hmm. Starting a trade war with China, Lithuania pushing the European, because basically you can't have a trade war with Lithuania. It is. You can't say, European Union free trade. It doesn't work, but that was there. And they also were very aware of the Hong Kongers doing in 2019 when the people who were going to run in the election were all put in prison. The University of Hong Kong students started a demonstration, Hands Across Hong Kong, which they celebrated the Baltic. I meet Hong Konger students on campus sometimes and say, what can Baltic get on? I say it was just as impossible for Baltic countries. It is the only thing that you could say as it is for Hong Kong. So these little things that are sort of below our radar are, for me, evidence of something going beyond puppets of the United States, doing things that we tell them to do. Saying, here's the big watershed moment when the United Nations General Assembly, the Parliament of the United Nations, voted to condemn the invasion of Ukraine. And they see people from different parts of the world. There's the map, you can find that elsewhere. The representative of Kenya says, we in Africa don't agree. All the problems we have, we don't want borders changed by military force. That's what's happened. Or annexation by military powers. We support this. And so there's this coalition of, these happen to all be democracies. These are those, you know, risk things where the pieces are all individual that you're fielding on that board. That for some reason or another, it's 3/4 of the United Nations condemns the aggressive change of borders and annexation of Ukrainian territory by Russia. Some countries are fence sitters. India, China, two fence sitters, of course. For their own, they have their own little border dispute that they might want to solve. For whatever reasons, they're still fence sitters. But when Latvians or Estonians, Lithuanians look around at this map, they say, there's many of us, actually. The pandemic, you look around and say, why is there, there's much more of us, the people who know that vaccines work, than there are of us. And you get strength out of that, and you get a little bit ambitious on what you can accomplish through geopolitics of a very different kind. Not based on terrain, but based on using that tool that was established in 1945, the United Nations, and those two declarations of who is good and who is not good in the world. And finding allies who agree on those three things. All right, so invasion of Ukraine, where for the Baltic everything was clear already before, for the world decade clarity on that new idealism issues. That you start seeing that you have been making Russia wealthy by engaging it financially. You have been making China wealthy by engaging it financially. And that wealth is used to destroy people like you. And deciding to shoulder the costs of disengaging from non-democracies and engaging with democracies, especially the fledgling democracies who need time, you know. Just kind of, their voters have elected Niger. Example. Voters just elected a democratic government, and before you know it, Wagner, Russian military, is there overthrowing them.
Right.
Given time to build faith in democracy is the agenda there, too. So there we go. So, skipping ahead, it's going to be 4 o'clock.
Okay. We can be up.
All right, if there's a takeaway, thinking about the world, the European Union, is a consensus of all those countries, by the way. Everything that the European Union does is by consensus. And that's very hard for Americans to understand. Where was I going with that? Looking at the Baltic, and it's a consensus among democracies, meaning every person making decisions in the European Union is answering to the voters in their countries. So who are the people that are leading these three countries? If you want to have voices of these three countries. There's just three examples. Three different kinds of political leaders, all of them democratically elected. There's the Prime Minister of Estonia, Kaja Kallas, who is probably the most visible voice of defending democracy in coming out of the Baltic, and one of the most visible voices today in the world. Well, I had some nice quotes from hers. She says, while we are defending democracy, we're always focusing on individual rights and rule of law. That is the objective. It's not just victory, it's victory of democracy that's our objective. Gabrielis Landsbergis, the foreign minister of Lithuania, doing lots of shuttle diplomacy. Japan is very much looking to see whether the United States honors its treaties of defense or not. South Korea, Japan keep sending their representatives to all the NATO to listen at NATO meetings. Gabrielis Landsbergis says, no peace without justice. If there are not people put on international trial, criminal tours, as they were after the first Holocaust and genocide the world decided to punish, then there's no justice. such as giving territories, not justice. That's Gabrielus Landgren. President Ignaz Rinkevich is the one who said, you know, we are ready to fight and die for our values, are you? And aside about him is that he is the first head of state in a NATO or European Union country, first head of state, which is the symbolic. It's like the power of the king in a little bit more, to be openly gay. Already now for many, many years, for like 8 years, I think, when he came out, it was not really a big deal because he's such a good foreign minister. And today he's the president of that. So as we're watching these countries, we kind of, there's all kinds of things we're watching, but we give them agency, we listen to them. So a Ukrainian would come into this room and say, Europe is all talking about Ukraine. You're talking around Ukraine, and there's no Ukraine at the table here, which is the issue in international global geopolitics. And so that would be a critique that I accept. You know, sure, it's true. It's okay to accept, you know, my mistakes and my sins, and then try to move on. So, and there's Kaya Kallas, who is the conclusion. She has identified the clear goal. She said the clear goal is to make freedom triumph over tyranny. That's why we're supporting Ukraine, not just to support Ukraine, not just to defeat Russia, but freedom over tyranny, democracy over, you know, monarchy has changed into dictatorships of all kinds, but basically one leader telling a country what to do, that system must be defeated in the long term. And so until Ukraine has won, she said, we have not done enough. That's what kind of policy. So that's the Baltic countries. They're not looking at us right now, they're looking at Ukraine. They're not even counting on us. They're counting on the largest tank army in Europe is Poland. A very formidable air force is Finland and the Scandinavian countries, which are bringing their air force together. So if, you know, the theme of this seminar of Europe without America, they prefer to have us in. If I have to say what they think, the countries, you know, this is stupid to talk about democracy, the country wants this. But they are very much have a plan for us not being there also. They will keep fighting even if we don't send weapons at this point. They won't stop fighting if we tell them, give land, let those people be genocided, just give that land to stop the war. They're not going to listen to us either. And so that would be the lesson of the Baltics for international geopolitics. They learned it from the European Union, by the way, founded on the values of the United Nations. And they're calling us all on that.
Yeah.
We need to